love Seattle. Dick, I don't know if you know this story. So we lived in Seattle for years. And so Seattle, it's gotten really crazy. It was crazy but livable until a few years ago. But Seattle's sort of isolated. And then there are these giant western states with not very many people in them. And so if you live in Seattle and you're constantly going to the East Coast, you're constantly doing these five-hour flights. And I was, when we were there, it's like, it'd just be much easier to live in D.C. I'm constantly going back there. And I told my wife, and I said, the thing is, I never get invited to speak in Wyoming or Montana or South Dakota or any of these big states that I fly over. And so we moved, and I think that was in July of 2013, and then Dick invited me to come speak in Billings in September. So, yeah, so now that I'm in Washington, I get to come to Montana, you know. But it's just, you know, I mean, the reality is, for good or for ill, a lot happens in Washington, D.C. So it's sort of like, you know, somebody's got to move to Rome or to Babylon, you know. So, but when we first moved, I had actually had a dream where I was back in Seattle when it's green, and I mean, the Pacific Northwest is just unbelievable, and when it's nice, it's nice. And I was actually crying in my dream. I was like, what was I thinking? You know, because in Virginia and in D.C., they talk about the mountains. And so it's a slight variation in the grade, you know. So, okay. Yeah, and we live by the water, which is the Potomac River, and people say, oh, you live by the water. Well, it's a muddy piece of, it's just a muddy thing, right? It's, you know. But so there, it has its benefits as well, though, so. All right, so we have talked about the diagnosis of what happened, the way in which the social contagion spread. Now, if you'll notice, I have a particular way of explaining things. And so I think the best explanations, when you're in the context of uncertainty and ignorance, what you do is you try to come up with explanations that are the most likely, the most plausible, given what you know. Because it's always possible some other thing could happen. And so in general, I think when you're explaining things that people do, your best bet is to try to explain what people do based upon their plausible motives. And not based on, it's satisfying to assume that people that do things that harm people did it for bad motives. Rarely, if you actually talk to people, like Washington, D.C. is not filled with people that said, I want to go to Washington, D.C. so I can harm everyone. Almost everyone, whatever their political ideology, actually thinks that what they are doing is for the common good and for the good of their fellow human beings. They disagree about what that is. They not only disagree about policies, they actually disagree now about what a human is, incidentally, and that has major consequences. So try, if you can, to explain things in terms of, okay, this person maybe thought he or she was doing something that helped people, but didn't for whatever reason. Because usually some people are just sociopaths, right? And they just want to see the world burn. There are people like that. But fortunately, if most people were sociopaths, well, we would still be rubbing sticks together. The fact that you can have functioning civilization tells you that most people, most of the time, don't steal from each other, they don't kill each other, they don't defraud each other. And I do think that a lot of what happens you can explain just in terms of people's natural incentives, given the fact that they were public health officials or that they were experts in one area that were suddenly making decisions in another area, or their kind of misunderstanding about how things work, like in the case of computer models. And so it's not that, that you don't need to posit a cabal of diabolical people to have catastrophic consequences. You can have people actually mostly doing what they thought by their own lights was the right thing to do and still have catastrophe. And that is probably the most important lesson about public policy and economics, is that you can have bad things happen that were based on actions that were actually good, that is, that were motivated by good things. You can have good things happen by motives that were bad. Right? They can go both ways. So that this is Adam Smith's point in The Wealth of Nations, the father of modern economics. He says it's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from his regard to his own interest. Now his point wasn't that interest is a bad thing. His point is just that the butcher doesn't need to be visualizing world peace in order to be a good butcher. He can just be thinking, I need to pay the rent and pay my daughter's braces. But to succeed as a butcher, he still needs to provide something for people that they'll freely buy and to do it better than his competitors. So in other words, you can pursue under a certain kind of market arrangement, your narrow interest and still benefit other people. Right? And so what's much easier is to assume the only time you have good outcomes is if they're good motives. And if you have bad outcomes, it must be the result of bad motives. The next level thinking is to say it's possible that people could act for good motives and still kill people, even though they didn't mean to, right? But it's much easier to kind of have those kind of simple lines. And I think that we're dealing with that. Now, once something happens, people, including power-hungry people, look for ways to exploit it. That's a different thing. But I don't think you need to assume that there were some smart people that could imagine exactly how this was going to go and so orchestrated from the beginning to explain this. So what was the price of the panic? In other words, the question is, not what was the price of the pandemic or the virus? That's a different question. The question is, what was the cost in lives and well-being and dollars and so forth of the policies that we pursued, and in particular, the massive lockdowns? I'm just using the word lockdowns to cover the designation that some jobs were inessential. The orders that said people couldn't go to church. The orders that said kids couldn't go to school. Right? That's what I mean by lockdowns. You were limited, in fact, in my county in suburban Washington, D.C., just outside D.C. in Maryland, there was a moment where if you were out on inessential business, you could be fined $1,000. Now, this is impossible to enforce, I can tell you because I tested it. But still, right? How are they going to tell if you're out on inessential business, right? That's the lockdowns. Now, I told you that I don't know exactly why public health officials who knew they probably would more advise lockdowns. But what's funny is a lot of the officials actually thought there was no use in pursuing lockdowns in any case because Americans wouldn't comply. In fact, Neil Ferguson said this. He said, well, it would be nice if we would do in the West what China did, if we would pursue the Chinese model of lockdowns, but of course people would never go for it. They were wrong, weren't they? They were completely wrong. I would have thought that too. If you'd asked me to bet, would people just not go to church because some health official they've never heard of told them not to? I thought, no way, that's not going to happen unless people are dropping in the streets. We complied. That's the great mystery, if anything, and we'll talk about that near the end. So how do you figure out the price of the panic? Okay, so I've just got a note here from Dick. I need to take my phone out. So I'm sorry, I was not listening to Dick a minute ago because my wife is asking me questions. There's always time-sensitive questions. Where's my phone? Okay. Oh, and it always sort of lands right when I'm talking. But I do have the ringer off. Okay, I turned it off. So somebody tell me if I go over because I don't know what time it is. So here's how you figure out the price of the panic. It's a really simple calculation. So you take the price of the pandemic if we had not pursued lockdowns, right? And then you subtract that from the price with the lockdowns. So where do you go to find that price? Is it at the New York Stock Exchange, or does the FDA give you that? No. It's complicated, unfortunately. I realized, because I'm the guy that does the economics, and then we got into it, I thought, how on earth am I ever going to figure out this number? And so we figured out a measure that I think got us. You just need to get within a billion or a few billion dollars. I said within, right when you talked. Fortunately, this level of magnitude, it's like, you know, within give or take $100 billion or something. So that's what we're doing. And so you can't say, well, everything that happened is the result of policy, because there would have been a cost, right, in terms of people not going to work, people getting sick, people dying, supply chain disruptions, all these kinds of things. Even if we hadn't pursued the lockdowns. So to really get a fair measure, you have to subtract the price of the virus itself, basically, from the overall. And then what you want to know is if the cost exceeded the benefits or the benefits exceeded the cost. So any good policy is going to be one in which the benefits of pursuing the policy exceed the cost of doing it. In other words, or of not pursuing it, right? This is just sort of common sense. And so that's why if you have a headache, you don't cut off your head, right? If you have a hangnail, you don't cut off your foot. Because it's like, that seems like a disproportionate response, right? In which the cost is way greater than the thing, of the thing, you know, as President Trump said, the cure is worse than the illness. And so that's, everybody knows this. Everyone involved in health policy knows this. This is why public health officials and economists talk in terms of life years rather than lives lost, because that's really the relevant measure. Remember, I mentioned that. It's a totally different thing if a virus causes people to die one day earlier than they would have died anyway. That's different than if it kills, you know, a small subset of people early in life. We can recognize, you know, the differences, and so you have to have a way of measuring that. And then economically, usually the way you measure things is you convert them into dollars. It's not because everything has a price, but you actually have a way of measuring that. And did you know that there's actually a fairly reliable way of figuring out how much a life year is worth in different countries? And the way you figure this out, it's sort of complicated, is what you do is you look at how much people are willing to spend on various safety measures. Because every safety measure you have adds to the cost of something. And so we want certain levels of safety, right? So we're willing to spend a little bit more to have airbags and seat belts and maybe roads that have shoulders and roads that don't collapse and all these kinds of things. It's like society is willing to spend a certain amount. Now, but what if we had a regulation that required that all cars be made of titanium and you know, carbon fiber shells and have massive bumpers on them, and so that every car costs $1 million, right? That's too much. And so it would create these sort of unnecessary problems. And so it turns out that a life year in the United States is actually in the millions of dollars. Now, its life years are worth less in much poorer countries. That does not mean people in poor countries are themselves worth less. That's not what's happening. What that means is that if your income, you spend 50% of your income just on food, then you're going to have less money that you can and are willing to spend on things like safety and insurance. That's perfectly rational. If you don't know where your next meal is coming from, then making your car 1% safer is not a reasonable sort of priority, right? And so there are ways, I'm telling you all this just so that you know there are actually fairly rational ways of measuring these costs. I don't want to give you all the details. We go into that in the book. So let me just give you kind of a rundown of this cost. Now, our book was very U.S.-centric, mainly because we were writing for an American context, and we can't tell the world what to do, but we thought we might be able to affect public policy in the U.S. But let's just talk a little bit about the world. So some of you may know that since 1990, about 1 billion people have emerged from absolute poverty around the world. So it's the greatest poverty reduction in all of human history in terms of both the percentage of the population and total numbers. And so the UN measures absolute poverty in terms of basically income per day. It's rough. It's like if a person per capita is living on less than $2 a day, they're in absolute poverty. So this is not the relative poverty that we suffer from. So we all suffer from horrible, horrible relative poverty compared to Jeff Bezos, right? Which just means he's way richer than us. But that is relative poverty. But if you have a house to live in and you can see the doctor when you need to, and you have all the food you need and you're able to stay warm, right, and those things, then you just suffer relative poverty but not absolute poverty. And really what we ought to be concerned about is absolute poverty. There'll always be relative poverty. No matter how wealthy people are per capita, there's always going to be some people that are richer than others. We should be concerned about the people that are at the very, very bottom. And that's why 1 billion people emerging from absolute poverty since 1990 is so significant. Now, does anybody know what UN program led to that emergence of 1 billion people? There wasn't one. It wasn't a UN program. In fact, I don't think the UN had anything to do with it. It was the increasing opening in trade in countries that were very sort of protected before, increase in technology and innovation, enterprise, property rights. And so, for instance, the country of India, which was basically a socialist country for the first 4 or 5 decades of its history in the 90s, started kind of de-socializing. And when you're dealing with 1 billion people, you know, one good policy can make a huge difference. And so that's the sort of good news. But as you know, if you can imagine, you go from, say, earning $2 a day to $4 a day, well, that's you've doubled your income. That's an improvement. But you're still just earning $4 a day, right, or $10 a day. And so you're still right down there at the edge. So that any change, say, in the cost of energy, can plunge you right back where you were before into complete and utter destitution and be at risk of starvation. We don't think about this, but the amount of time that Americans have to work in order to feed themselves has been going down continually and consistently for all of the 20th century. So that most of us now, it's actually a historically low percentage of our income is spent on food. But imagine if 60% of all of your income went just to feeding you and your family. Well, the main cost of food, or one of the main costs of food, is the cost of energy. And so if the price of oil goes up 20% or 50%, all of a sudden the price of food, you're spending all of your income just to eat. So that's why these kinds of economic policies matter, and why those of us that are really interested in this subject worried about this, because we knew even slight shocks to the food supply chains could be catastrophic for people that are just right on the edge. Now, what did we do in the United States? So in March, I was talking to a woman here at the beginning about this. Do you remember what happened in the U.S. and everybody heard that there might be lockdowns? Toilet paper, all right? I don't actually have an answer to this, because toilet paper is easily substitutable. I mean, the truth of the matter is most of the human race lived for most of history without toilet paper. True, right? And so if you're going to say, okay, what do I need as an essential? I'm surprised it would occur to people that that's it. Instead, it was bullets and toilet paper, right? I kind of get the bullets. And hand sanitizer. So we are still, and remember, hand sanitizer disappeared. That one sort of made sense because we thought it might, you know, help us with the spread of the virus. But notice what we were focusing on, right? The truth of the matter is the food supply chain in the United States was massively disrupted, but it was mostly in the retail sectors. So the retail would be the food that goes from a farm to Applebee's, right? Or to the Outback Steakhouse. That is one, that's a supply chain. And that's different from the farm to grocery store or farm to Costco supply chain. Those trucks and contracts are all in place. And so if suddenly restaurants all have to close, one of the supply chains is going to be disrupted. And I remember at one point, at the height of the lockdowns, I think farmers in Minnesota alone were having to kill 10,000 hogs a day. Because the pigs are going to get fat and want to be fed. There's no place to put them, and so you just end up killing them, and you end up having to dump milk into a ravine or something like that. But we didn't generally suffer food shortages. So the food supply chain, prices went up, but still get groceries. Probably very few of us actually went without a meal. So that tells you something. That tells you we have an incredibly wealthy and robust economy. But you know what the UN food program, there's a World Food Program is another arm of the United Nations. So while the World Health Organization was proposing lockdowns, the UN food program was trying to figure out, okay, how's this going to affect food supply chains? So let me just give you their conclusion. This was in 2020. This is why it was going on. This is what David Beasley said. He said that in the events of 2020 could plunge as many as 420 million more people into extreme poverty, defined as earning less than $2 a day. So almost half of those people that emerged from absolute poverty in a matter of weeks could drop back below it, 420. Now, what does that mean? So he said he predicted that shocks to the food supply chains could lead to 300,000 deaths per day. 300,000. So just compare that in magnitude to the deaths from COVID, right? It wouldn't take long, if that's right, before the number of people that died of starvation exceeded the number of people that died from COVID-19 itself. All because of a subtle thing that most people don't ever think about of supply chains. That's just crazy. Now that by itself, in some ways you don't, if you're worrying about the whole human race, right, and especially the least of those among us, that alone tells you we should probably think twice before we do anything to disrupt that supply chain. That was the global context. We've not been able to nail these numbers down one way or the other, because as you can guess, they're relying on models as well, right? And so we'll know probably about 2024, 2025, there'll be an after action report, we'll have the data and we'll be able to compare it. Let's say he's off by an order of magnitude so that it was only 30,000 deaths a day. Well, you're still dealing with, you know, a million people, coming up on a million people a month just from that. Right? So you can see how very quickly, now, most of us probably didn't think about the global supply chain leading to massive deaths among poor people. Just didn't occur to us. Right? But that's people that think about trade and economics knew this almost immediately. So much so that one office of the UN was complaining about it while another office of the UN was advocating the very policy that was causing that. Now, if you read it, there was some delusion because they were referring to it as if the virus did this. Well, the virus didn't tell ships to quit shipping stuff, right? It was something else. So how much did it cost in terms of the economy? Well, total, we estimated during the initial lockdowns, it was about $1.2 trillion a month. But we think that worst case scenario, the virus might have been 200 billion. So we'll say a trillion. We'll just round down to account for the cost of the virus itself. So $1 trillion a month from the lockdowns. Now, we don't care about the dollars. The dollars represent human capacity. So we're talking about, this is just a way of measuring output in a farm, in a factory, in the service industry, people being able to pay their rents, people being able to pay the dentist or buy food at the grocery store. It's all that stuff that we're measuring. And so you can talk about a kind of the total amount of wealth in an economy. Well, $1 trillion shave a month. I know we've gotten used to talking about $1 trillion, but that's still kind of a lot of money, especially if you keep running through it every month. And of course, with the reason that the stimulus responses were so dramatic and the deficit spending was so dramatic is because you also, tax receipts go down, right? So when people lose their jobs and nobody's paying taxes, then the government is spending more money and actually taking less in. And that can itself end up being a drag on the economy. So there's just a complete mess there. Yeah. Tell me not to ramble if I get on these econ things. That's where I can ramble. All right, so, but this is a nice kind of round number, that, and we measured it in three different ways. That's how we came up with that. Sort of similar. So what about jobless? Well, some of you probably were watching this. By May of 2020, starting in March. So February of 2020, the United States had historically low unemployment. In fact, you can only get to about 2% unemployment. That is full employment because there's always somebody moving jobs. We were amazingly close to that in February. And by May, there were over 40 million new jobless claims. So this would be not people that were long-term unemployed, but people that had never, you know, knew, so they had had maybe long-term jobs. Now, lots of those, this is a tricky one because that was a huge thing at the beginning. A lot of those have returned, and in fact, I saw on the news just this morning on the Saturday Today Show, which is on in the hotel lobby, that there are a bunch of places that have massive labor shortage now, which is a very sort of strange thing. And that can only happen if large numbers of people have just kind of checked out of the labor pool altogether. That's because otherwise you'd have massive unemployment. That's not showing that. So what I think has happened is a lot of people that were working that didn't have to or that had alternatives have just kind of are just not in the system at all anymore. And, but I mean, this is, you can think of these as isolated jobs, but in many cases this was businesses. So I live in a part of Washington, D.C. I don't know why. So there are a bunch of family-owned Mexican restaurants all around where we live in suburban Washington, D.C., and they're all owned by families. Well, so imagine that you and your wife and your kids and your cousins and you've all of your income and all of the work that you've done on second jobs, probably landscaping, that you've poured into this business for years, and then you're told you're not allowed to allow customers in for 4 months. That business is gone forever. It's just gone forever. You might be able to find a job later, right? But your investment of your whole life in this small business is completely gone. This was the kind of, in terms of a policy, it was the greatest devastation to small business, and the way the policies worked with essential and inessential business, it ended up being very favorable to companies that were digitized, right? By definition. And so it's very good for Amazon. I don't think somebody said, what do we do to help Jeff Bezos? Because people kind of don't like him anyway. But if you're a digital company, right, and that's just doing everything in terms of delivery, then you can digitize. But if you're an analog company, like a restaurant that's feeding people in person, there's no way to digitize that. You, by definition, you can't digitize in-person dining, right? And so that is, I think, just kind of long-term catastrophe that could take who knows how many years to recover from that. That is the price of the panic. Deaths of despair. Now, deaths of despair, this is actually, it's a term of art that refers to the deaths that are incurred by people dying from suicide, alcohol overdoses, and drug overdoses. There's a wonderful book by Nobel laureate economist named Angus Deaton at Princeton. It's a really good book about this kind of stuff. And this is a weird sort of thing. So if you look, actually, there's a weird dynamics. This is pre-COVID. If you track the average life expectancy of white males in the United States, we've been slowly going up. And you don't just keep going up. And so, it, you know, we sort of, everybody sort of doubled life expectancy a century and a half ago or so. And then we've been sort of inching up, and women live longer than we do because we have the men have to live with their wives and they drive into an early grave. Theories vary, but in any case, women live longer. And so if you track white males, in the last few years before COVID, the average life expectancy dipped for the first time in history. Now, why is that? Well, it's probably mostly deaths of despair because of opioid addiction. So opioid addiction is a thing that people do when they're depressed, you know, and so you might go into the hospital. Now, I've had to draw down off of heavy opioids twice for medical reasons. It is unpleasant. You can do it, but you have to draw down, you have to be intentional. If you don't have any reason or motive, I can see how you'd stay addicted to it. But it's also really easy to overdose on this stuff and you just quit breathing. And so that was happening already. Now what happens when tens of millions of people are put out of work and they're locked up in their houses by themselves and they can't go out, and they can't go to the gym, and they can't go to church? What do you think is going to happen? You're going to increase deaths of despair. We just don't know what the number of this is. But we do know that I think the most conservative estimate is that the first few months, in one study, it estimated there would be 75,000 excess deaths of despair above and beyond what you would have expected in those few months of the lockdown. And so by now, I'm sure it's going to be up in the hundreds of thousands. So that's drug and alcohol overdoses, accidental overdoses, and intentional suicides. This is a map of deaths per 100,000. And they do tend to sort of cluster in particular places for sort of complicated sociological reasons. If you're curious, you can read this book by Deaton. All right, so these are things that people do behaviorally as a result of a change in conditions. I mean, so what did we think was going to happen? You know? This is devastating. Delays in treatment to diagnosis. So our editor at Regnery Publishing, she's the publisher that published our book, she had breast cancer, I think, I don't know if it was 10 or 12 years ago. And so anyone in the room that's had breast cancer, any kind of cancer like this, you know that you will have surgery or maybe you have chemo or radiation and you can go into remission and you can be well, but you want to keep checking it. So the doctors want to see you fairly frequently, and then it's every 6 months, and then maybe at least once a year, and you do some scans. And so y'all remember in March and April, part of the lockdowns was that hospitals canceled elective procedures. Now, when I heard elective procedures, I thought, oh, well, they're talking about nose jobs and liposuction, right? That's like that. It's stuff that you don't need to do. And so they scheduled that. Now, why did they do that? They didn't remember because of that curve we saw earlier. Is that the idea was, okay, that the hospitals are going to get hit. We're going to need every extra bed that we can. We can't have people recovering from other procedures because COVID's the most deadly thing ever. I mean, that was essentially the policy. It's the most deadly thing ever, and it takes precedent over everything else that people get sick and die of. I mean, that's the only thing that really justified this policy, was that it was somehow worse than everything else. And so this is why, for instance, the now former Governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo. I'm sorry, I'm laughing, but right. It's again these politicians, so they can move and cause tens of thousands of people to die, because what they would do is people would, elderly people in nursing homes would go to the hospital, they would get COVID-19, and then in New York they moved them back into the nursing homes to the places where people were at risk, which is what you would do if you wanted to kill people. Now the reason for this was only one, to keep the hospitals empty. Now someone should have been called to account for this policy. We know who called for it. He sold a multi-million dollar book to a publisher, lionizing himself about his response to the COVID-19 crisis. That didn't ding his career at all. It's fine, right? But it turns out he seems to be a sexual harasser. He seems to do what lots of politicians have, seem to have no executive function at all, right? And so that's what sort of did. But this was the result of this policy. We got to keep hospitals empty. Well, elective procedure, what that actually means, it's a term of art, which I learned, means it's on the schedule. So in other words, it's not something you didn't sever your leg and show up at the emergency room. That would be non-elective, right? So you got to do something right away. It's something that's actually on the schedule. So that could have been a surgery for a new knee. It could have been cancer surgery. Or it could have been a screening for cancer. Or it could have been a test for cancer that you are in remission, but you always want to stay on it. All right? And so that undoubtedly led to many, many thousands of deaths and sickness. And so there's a bunch of kind of disparate statistics on this. It's frustrating because at the moment we don't know the exact numbers. We just have sort of ballparks. So let me give you a sort of an example. So a Medscape lockdown predicted that just until June, okay, a 3-month lockdown in the U.S. they thought would could mean about 80,000 missed cancer diagnoses. That was initially. That's just cancer diagnoses. And then Scott Atlas did a later analysis about cancer screening specifically, and he thinks about 78% of cancers were missed during the lockdowns. So he extrapolated 9 months out, which would mean that 750,000 to 1 million cancers were missed during the 2020 lockdown, so from March until the end of the year. Now that doesn't mean 750,000 people died of cancer as a result of that. It means people that could have had their cancer detected early on, maybe got it ended up from stage 1 to stage 3. We don't know how many of those people end up much worse off, and how many of those people died as a result. We just don't know those numbers. But I want that you get a sense, right, of the kind of magnitude of this. Because when you hear hundreds of thousands of people died either with or from COVID, that sounds enormous. But you want to know, okay, what does it compare to exactly? Because whatever that is, we don't want a policy on the other side that will kill just as many or more people, right? And we managed to find a policy that did exactly that. And so I would not be a bit surprised to learn in a couple of years that as many people died from missed cancer screenings alone as from COVID in 2020. And I'm just talking about cancer. I'm not talking about heart disease or anything else, just cancer. Now those are measurable, so stay tuned. But the Atlas thinks the national lockdown is responsible for at least 700,000 lost lives. That's what Atlas thought. Now, who is Atlas? Do y'all remember him? Yeah. So he was the guy that was at Stanford that was analyzing this. Now, his expertise is healthcare policy. So if you were talking about lockdowns, right, you say, now, who would be the expert on lockdown? Would it be somebody whose specialist is studying the AIDS virus? Right? It's a virus. Right? Would it be somebody that studies the malaria parasite? It's a parasite. No, the relevant expertise would be somebody that knows how to analyze policies and think in terms of costs and benefits. Dr. Anthony Fauci was distinctly incapable of this type of thinking. If you remember when he was, people were starting to complain about lockdowns and the press asked him about the problem with lockdowns, what did he say? He said, well, I'm concerned about health and I know that it may prove to be an inconvenience to people. Okay, that is a tell, that's a shibboleth of somebody that is incapable of understanding that policies can kill people. And so the fact that you're focusing on one thing that can kill people doesn't mean there aren't other things that can kill people. right? And so a healthcare policy expert is exactly who you would want to talk to. That was Scott Atlas. And unfortunately, President Trump he spent months not listening to these people and not hearing from them. And he finally brought Atlas to Washington, D.C. And then Atlas was, of course, a single target of a trillion arrows. There were literally dozens of scientists like this. The president should have brought all of them to Washington, D.C. and just had continual press conferences with them and just provide, you know, it should bludgeon the media with this stuff because they didn't know anything. Instead, it was just poor Scott Atlas by himself. He came to D.C. He didn't even rent an apartment. He stayed at the Trump International Hotel the whole time he was in D.C. So that was a little unsecret. If you wanted to talk to Scott Atlas, you just went to the Trump Hotel at about 10 o'clock at night, go to the bar by himself, right? But that's, you know, again, we didn't do that. We didn't focus on the kind of relevant experts when we were thinking about policies. Do you remember a major vigorous debate in which we were arguing about different types of responses and you got the best people on all sides of that and you debated the lockdowns and then you did them? No. We're just supposed to think, well, of course, some smart person knows that lockdowns is what you do. That's the response. When in fact, it was not at all the response. In fact, it's genuinely outrageous. So those are the sort of measurable things. What about this? So I was on the plane flying out here, and I was in a three-way seat on the bulkhead. And of course, those of you that fly a lot, you know when you're sitting, you're first one seated, and you're sort of hoping no one's going to sit next to you. And if at least somebody's going to come, you're hoping it's a tiny little woman and not this giant linebacker, right? And so when I show up and I'm in the middle seat, I always apologize. I know you're hoping I was going to be a tiny little woman. No, it's me. My shoulder is going to be bothering you. Well, so I was sitting there, and a man came with the diaper bag and said, "Bad news. 19-month-old, she's coming, first trip since she was born." And then her wife came, and so, you know, she's doing what 19-month-old do. They just are just sort of crazy and noisy on planes. And he was feeding her avocado toast. This is a coaster thing, you know. Not donuts. He went to Dunkin' Donuts, and he got her avocado toast. Does this occur to anyone? So anyway, he just did everything for 3 hours on the way to Denver. But we all had to wear masks. And the little girl was really upset the whole time, right? Now, at one point, I took my mask off because I had my hydro flask right here. So by the way, this is what I do on planes. You fill this bad boy up and you sip it really slowly, right? And so I was sipping, so I was able to take my mask off, and I looked over at her. And she just immediately lit up and got quiet like this. Now, this is a sample size of one, I admit, right? And it totally confirmed my priors, my prejudices on this, was that children need to have human faces that they look at, right? This just seems so manifestly obvious to me. Prior to any data, it just seems obvious. I mean, monkeys, for goodness sake, respond to our faces. So we think that toddlers don't need that? We know that they do. And so now what has happened? So if you're 18 months old, you have lived your entire life, if you go out in public, seeing adults with their faces covered. Now, if you're a little older, you've also been, the last 18 months of your life has been since seeing adults with their faces covered. And you've been being told by everyone that they're potentially deadly vectors of disease and death. Right, so we are teaching children that other people aren't other neighbors, right, that you can learn things from and talk to, but they're carriers of deadly viruses. That's the primary message. In case they didn't hear it, they get a visual symbol of that everywhere they go. Now, I have absolutely no way of verifying ahead of time what the cost of that is going to be, and neither does anyone else. An emerging number of psychologists are starting to talk about it, though. But you know what? We're running the experiment. We're going to find out. So what does this do in terms of anxiety and social capacity and control and the ability to interpret people's emotions, which turns out to be a really, really useful skill if you ever want to get married or deal with other people? Being able to interpret people's facial expressions is a really useful and subtle thing that doesn't reduce to rules. And if you're literally preventing someone from doing that if you keep everybody's faces covered. And so at the very least, what we should have said with masks is the evidence that this is useful better be really high, because there is this massive, uncountable cost socially and psychologically for the vulnerable parts of the population if we don't do it. Oh, and by the way, they're the ones that are at least at risk from the virus.
Yes.
And so the fact that their teachers union is still saying they need to be masked up, this has nothing to do with the science. And I don't know what it has to do with, because anybody that's half bright knows that doesn't make any sense. Little kids are not transmitting the virus to each other. When they get it, they're very unlikely to be sick from it. And so it really doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, speculate all you want. That is likely long-term damage that is very, very difficult to put a price on. On the other hand, on the bright side, if you're trying to decide what to do as a career, maybe trauma counseling for children, and maybe that's going to be a growth industry. I don't know, right? We don't know whether they'll laugh or cry at that. This is massive, and we complied with this overwhelmingly. That is the central mystery. We complied with this. Now, I keep saying that because later, we're going to talk about what I think the argument was that led us to comply with it. All right, so they're countable costs in terms of jobs, in terms of dollars, in terms of missed cancer screenings, in terms of deaths of despair, in terms of psychological and social damage to children in particular, which we will only find out long term. And then just the miscellany of costs that I have no idea how to measure. So what about you're Christian and you like to go to church? And in fact, you think one of the most important duties and things that you have to do is to go to church. If you're Catholic or Eastern Orthodox, right, and you're Eucharistically oriented, you like literally want to go and participate in the body and the blood of Christ. And if you can't do that on the internet, it turns out. It's not a way to do that. You can listen to sermons, at least, on the internet, but Eucharistically, you can't participate in certain sacraments in the same way. Well, how do you measure that? And again, how quickly and compliantly we agreed. That's what's so strange. There were a few standouts. So I think about John MacArthur's church in California and Capital Baptist in Washington, D.C. Isolated little, notice these aren't denominations, these were individual congregations that decided that they say, no, we're just going to bring all the elderly people in here and have them all coughing on each other. They didn't say that. They said, no, we're going to do things to take account of this, and maybe we'll spread people out more, and that's not the issue. The issue is that the state doesn't have the authority to tell us we cannot gather for worship, except in extreme circumstances and for a very limited period of time. And what we found was that when churches did this, or when organizations brought the governor of Michigan to court, right, for doing this, they discovered that they had about 30 days leeway to exercise this emergency authorization powers, and then they didn't have it. They were all out past their authority. But we didn't know that, because people didn't generally even test it. They didn't sue it. Now, why did not every church in the country immediately show up at courts and sue the relevant public authorities? That didn't mean the churches were going to not do anything about it. Just simply as a matter of principle to establish, actually the state doesn't have the authority to unilaterally, permanently tell us we can't go to church. And then the reason is because we think, okay, a public health argument somehow changes it. So you know that perfectly well when it comes to other things, right? You know that the state wouldn't have justly used that authority in other things, but when it comes to public health issues, we thought, okay, that's somehow a weird exception to this. And even if it is, notice what incentives we're going to set up in the future for using the power of the state. That's the danger. So the churches, the schools, so I don't know how many of you saw this, and this is both bad, and so I'm a little bit mixed on this. So my kids were homeschooled and then in a couple of years of private school, and I'm frustrated about public schools, and I know there are a lot of good people in the system, but I'm frustrated by it. And so when people would hear me complain, they'd say, well, maybe it's better that kids aren't in the schools. I don't know. So granted, maybe there are some benefits to it. The only real benefit in terms that I saw was that a lot of parents actually witnessed directly what their kids were being taught. And by the way, so as of a few weeks ago, 11% of the U.S. population is now homeschooling their kids. So it went from 1% to 5% to 11%, right? And it's almost all because of that. And by the way, it's the percentages are higher among ethnic minorities, in particular Latinos and Black Americans, right? Who also overwhelmingly in the worst public schools. So it makes perfect sense. And all of a sudden they're like, what's this? And so they figure out that they can do it. And so the dirty little secret about homeschooling is that everybody thinks they can't do it. And the people that homeschool realize, actually, you can. You don't really have to be that smart to educate third graders, especially ones that you love. You know, you have an incentive to have it work. So that was a sort of silver lining. But what we had is tens of millions of kids, first graders, second graders, third graders, on Zoom classes and Microsoft meetings and Teams. Now, a bunch of you have probably spent the last year and a half on Zoom, as I have. Heck, I wrote a book on Zoom and using Google Docs. So do you focus really well doing that? Yeah, have you ever tried listening to a long lecture on American history or Montanan history, probably in the seventh grade, or Texas history if you're in Texas, on Zoom? Right? This is not pedagogically wise. It's okay temporarily for certain uses, but it's very likely that there are millions and millions of kids, and it's not the kids going to Sidwell Friends School. It's the kids going to local public schools in poor neighborhoods that just basically had a year and a half of education taken from them. In fact, they're just gone, right? And they're going to always be behind. And trust me, it wasn't the private schools, because in Washington, D.C., mysteriously in Washington, D.C., the virus was scared of kids that were wearing uniforms in preppy schools. It didn't go there. Yeah, but then across the street, the public schools, the virus just knew where to go. It was amazing. Yeah, it's the weirdest thing. Very smart virus. And so again, what's weird about this is that people on the left, that's what was so weird to me. There are a few noble left-wingers that have been really strong critics of the lockdowns, but generally, they've all been all in on this. And I thought, you're the people that are supposedly constantly talking about inequalities between the rich and the poor, and we've got a policy that has done more than anything in human history to basically privilege the wealthy and to punish the poor. And you think this was a good idea. That is exactly what happened. My kids did not suffer at all educationally. They didn't like some of the online stuff, but they got to go back in person as soon as they could. And they had kind of a support system. Instead, imagine you're a single mom, and you've got to quit part of your job in order to try to figure out how to homeschool your kid or watch him while he's on Zoom. This is a disaster. So I just tell you that because this is a cost. And it was a cost of a particular policy of lockdowns that did not have to be pursued and that was not based upon the scientific evidence and that we now know didn't make any difference in the spread of the virus. And we're still talking about it, right? And so at some point, this just gets more and more and more absurd. So that is the price of the panic, not the price of the virus, the price of a very bad set of policy decisions that George Gilder says are the greatest policy disaster in human history. And he's not counting sort of nationalization of the farms, or just simple public health policies. It's hard to imagine what could have been worse. And we could have done what Sweden did. We could have done what Florida did. But we didn't do it, and we're still not having a kind of rational discussion about it. So that is the price of the panic. And my hope, honestly, is just that enough of us can understand this, that we don't fall for it again, and we insist on somebody showing the evidence of the virtues and the benefits of a policy before we go along the next time. So why don't we take a few questions, and then we'll have a break.
Well, we really won't.
Or we really won't have a break. We'll end it.
Oh, okay.
But first, I get the first question. But first of all, thank you, my friend, for coming to Billings.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
I had a lady come to me, and she asked me a really good question. multifaceted. But it was about globalism, simplistically saying. How many of you were or aware of what Agenda 21 is, was? That's scary. That ought to be all of you. I'd like to ask you to explain that, but that's a whole forum.
It is.
We are going to attempt. I got a lot of balls in the air right now. One of those balls is we're going to try and bring in somebody in mid to late February to do something like this on globalism, particularly Agenda 21, Agenda 30. So stay tuned. We're working with our central committee, and we will be working with Ed and others. This is a huge, huge issue. If you didn't know what Agenda 21 and 30 is, start researching. My question is just simply this. You know, a couple of years ago, we brought in this dude to talk on Marxism. I've forgotten his name.
Well, that was me. Yeah. Like I said, I was on opioids at the time, so.
But one of the questions, 2-minute answer.
Okay.
As we look at Marxism and influence versus globalism, just comment on that.
Absolutely. And now, Dick, tell me, I'm the speaker, so you think I'd know this, but when are we supposed to end for good?
We'll end for good in about 11:20.
11:20 total?
11:20.
Well, why don't I quickly answer that then, actually? This is the uncounted cost, it's freedom. And this was the mystery, and we were willing to give that up. Now, I do not think that all these things that have happened were something that was directed by a cabal of people. And the reason is it would have required being able to read the minds of billions of people and to know what they did. And this is why these predictive computer models don't work, is because that complicated model I told you about, it assumed certain things that people would do under certain circumstances that turns out were wrong. So all the officially smart people thought Americans wouldn't comply with the Chinese-style lockdown, and yet we did, right? That is a very strange thing. But as a result of that, the people who have larger designs now know that we're willing to do that. Under certain circumstances, we are willing to comply, and we are willing to give up our freedom. One of the people like that, I'll just call them the officially smart people. This guy named Klaus Schwab and the Great Reset. The Great Reset is his term of art. Now, Klaus Schwab, who is he? He is born in 1938. He's Swiss. He's an engineer and an economist. He founded several decades ago something called the World Economic Forum. You've heard of it because it's called Davos, because there's an annual conference always in the winter in Davos, Switzerland, where people like John Kerry fly their private planes in to talk about global warming, right? And so, you know, so let me take my plane to Davos and complain about people in Montana who are using coal, right? That's what Davos is. So it's always lots of NGOs, influential religious leaders, influential business leaders, people like that. If you want to know, so some of the terms that he has coined and popularized, global governance, biosecurity, the new normal, the New Deal for Nature, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which I've written about, and something called stakeholder capitalism. Now, Dick asked about globalism and Marxism, and so what I want you to see here is that the challenge that we're dealing with in the 21st century is not exactly like the challenge of the 20th century. In the Cold War in the 20th century, our primary challenge was the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was a Marxist-Leninist regime that implemented state socialism in which they entirely nationalized the means of production, which meant that there were no private businesses, no private farms. So entirely owned and controlled by the state, wages dictated by the state, prices dictated by the state, a complete command economy. This was bound to end in their failure because this is just a disaster economically for lots of well-understood reasons. That was one manifestation of the Marxist worldview. Now, the temptation is to think, okay, that's what we need to look out for. Either to think Marxism is gone, or that if Marxism manifests itself, it's going to look like that. It's not going to look like that. Not even AOC and Bernie Sanders are talking about nationalizing the farms. Right? Because the reason is if you did that, the economy would immediately collapse and they would all get driven out of office. It's the same reason they don't call for $200 minimum wage, right? It would be obviously a disaster. What we have emerging, what I think is the primary threat to the traditional American way of life, with life of freedom and true liberty, is a weird kind of collusion between powerful elites in business, government, and NGOs. In which these things fuse. So there's still private business, there's large thriving business, there's still prices, right? They're not owned by the government, they're not owned by the UN or the US, but the vast and growing administrative state, both at the national and the international level, collude with these large economic actors for the good of humanity in their own view. And that's a different thing. And it benefits from certain types of cultural Marxism in the culture to destabilize individual nations. And so that's the benefit of it. But trust me, these guys are not committed Marxists or Stalinists in the sense that they believe in the proletariat. Right? What they believe in is a technocracy and a particular elites managing global civilization for the good of everyone. Now, this sounds like one of these conspiracy theories, except that he talks about it on the internet. He says it explicitly. And he explicitly said this with respect to the Great Reset, which is the attempt to reset global civilization in light of the pandemic and to do things that they thought they couldn't do before. So here's what he says. He says, the pandemic represents a rare but narrow window of opportunity to reflect, reimagine, and reset our world. Right, here we go again. A new world could emerge, the contours of which it is incumbent upon us to reimagine and to redraw. Now, why is he saying that? Well, he's saying that because he realized, actually, there are forms of social control that we thought wouldn't work. We didn't think entire populations of free countries was willing, under certain circumstances, to comply with these things. So what does the World Economic Forum seek? So here's their seven key themes. Environmental sustainability, fairer economies, tech for good. We talk about the future of work and the need for reskilling. He's also kind of a transhumanist who thinks we're going to get replaced by robots. That's another thing. Things called better businesses, healthy futures with fair access for all, and building back better. Right? Or as we're saying now at Heritage, build bureaucracy better. And my favorite is build bigger bureaucracy, right? Which is what it actually is. And national governments collaborating globally. All right, so that's the vision. And this idea has existed for a century. I use this term technocracy. This was actually popular. There was actually a magazine about this way back in the 1930s. It was talking in a magazine called The Technocrat. Here's how technocracy was defined. It's the science of social engineering, the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population of this continent. All right, global governance. Do not think of this as the Soviet Union. China might be closer, but what's happening is that you have a Marxist regime in China which has implemented certain market reforms in order to develop, but still controls its, it has private businesses that it controls. The US is moving the other way from a mostly free economy to one in which the administrative state owns, and doesn't own, but controls more and more or less a private industry in collusion, but kind of converging on the same sort of economic model. That's the way to picture it. And the plan, because they told us this, so this is nothing weird and far-fetched, I'm just gonna tell you what they say on their website, is that we need a series of lockdowns just like we've had for COVID-19, but for other things. And some of you have already guessed what the next public health crisis is going to be. It's going to be climate change. And in fact, just a few months ago, an official of the World Health Organization said we need climate lockdowns. Now, why is that? Well, if you don't drive and you can't get on airplanes and you can't leave the house, you shrink your carbon footprint a little bit, right? That's the basic, it's really, really obvious. Now, what's crucial about this, though? Would we have bought this 10 years ago, global climate change? No. So what did I tell you that, what is the circumstance under which we comply? Public health. So everything has to now be framed in terms of public health. Because they now know. These are guys that wanted to be able to pursue these visions, but you know, there are other people with similar visions that compete against them. That's why these people never really can get a lot of power. They talk about it and gather, but they don't do a lot. Now they realize actually it's possible to get populations to comply as long as you frame it in terms of public health. And so just trust me on this. And if you don't trust me, at least be on the lookout for climate change and global warming being framed, not as a scientific issue that we can debate, but as a public health crisis. Here's how Anthony Fauci put it in a scientific paper. He talked about the powers of the UN and the World Health Organization, the need for them to be strengthened in order to rebuild the infrastructure of human existence. All right? And one of the first things President Biden did when he got into office is to issue an executive order framing public health in terms of climate change in terms of public health. And the Department of Health and Human Services has just announced a new office called the Office of Climate Change and Health Equity. This is in the Health and Human Services Department, all right? So they're already doing it. It's already happening. This is where we go next. And trust me on this, everything gets framed going forward in terms of public health. And the reason is because we complied. Why did we comply? Here's why I think we complied. It's because of a moral jujitsu. So this is the sort of stereotypical thing about the learning jujitsu or learning judo is that you learn to use your enemy's weight against him. Right, so you have a big, heavy guy, right? But if you're a small guy and you're fighting a really big, heavy guy, you don't want to get grabbed, right? What you want to do is hope for him to push, you know, really punch at you slowly because he's big, and then give you the opportunity to pull him in the same direction as his thrust so that all of his momentum goes against him. Well, in the moral jujitsu is when you use someone's moral principles in order to flip them. And so the reality is that we care for the most part about other people. None of us want to be responsible for causing some elderly person in our church to get sick. None of us want that. And so we were not used to that argument, to be told, okay, look, you need to not go to church and not go to your jobs and not send your kid to school, not for your own good necessarily, but because you might asymptomatically be carrying a deadly respiratory virus and unbeknownst to you, we'll spread it to someone else who's more vulnerable and kill them. Right? That was, I'm telling you, that was the Twitter thing. If you wanted to go outside, you didn't care about grandma. Now that's tough, right? What do you say to that exactly? Because they're not saying give up your freedom because it's good for you. It's a give up your freedom to help those who are less vulnerable. And it actually had a plausible framing in terms of asymptomatic spread. And so we've got to figure out how to think our way out of that. It's a complicated story, but I want you to just, I'll put it sort of baldly. You do not have a moral obligation, right, to stay locked up because unbeknownst to you, you might be carrying a virus that might kill people. If you did have a moral obligation like that, you could never leave your house because you could be carrying the cold. And you could be carrying the flu asymptomatically. Somebody caused me to get the flu in 2016. I ended up with pneumonia. I ended up with pleural effusion in the hospital with four tubes coming out of my side. All because I'd gotten a very, very mild case of the flu. Somebody gave it to me, probably asymptomatically. Do I blame them? Of course not. They didn't know they had it. And so we can't possibly be under an obligation never to go outside because we might be carrying something that would make someone sick. Right? So that means if we're social beings, the moral obligation's got to be more detailed than that. It's something like this. If you know you're sick and are contagious, you need to take proper precautions to make sure other people don't get it. But that's not what they sold us on. They sold us on this idea of asymptomatic spread and then gave us the impression we had a different moral obligation that they'd never held us to before. And so we got to work our way back out of that. We've got to recognize what our genuine moral obligation is and be willing to be accused, right, of being evil. Because we just think, look, no one has that moral obligation. I'm sorry. Because we're social beings. Here's how C.S. Lewis put it. Because here, I think we're dealing with the tyranny of those exercised for the good of its victims. He said, of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. It would be better to live under robber barons than under omnipotent moral busybodies. The robber baron's cruelty may sometimes sleep, his cupidity may at some point be satiated, but those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience. They may be more likely to go to heaven, yet at the same time likelier to make a hell of earth. This very kindness stings with intolerable insult. To be cured against one's will and cured of states which we may not regard as disease is to be put on a level of those who have not yet reached the stage of reason, or those who never will, to be classed with infants, imbeciles, and domestic animals. The tyranny of those who exercise it for the good of its victims. That is what we're dealing with, and that is what we must learn to resist. How do we do that? First, we've got to teach ourselves what happened in this case. We've got to inoculate ourselves against the bad ideas. I hope I modeled learning to think probabilistically, avoid the satisfying narratives, distinguish real from manufactured consent and expertise, and figure out how we're going to respond the next time when somebody tries to pull that false moral jiu-jitsu on us. We've got to figure out how to fight against the brave new normal. Thank you very much. Yeah.